Alors, nous allons écouter maintenant notre dernière intervenante, Emilia Sanabria, qui va parler de Uncertain Evidence, Scales, Bodies and Environments in Obesity Science.
Merci beaucoup. So I'm going to take you back to France, where this research is based. And here in France, three major public health initiatives were launched to tackle non-communicable chronic diseases that are associated with high body mass indexes. And just to sort of carry on from what Gaia was saying, it's significant that two of these, the Plan Obésité and the PNNS, the Programme National Nutrition Santé, are run by the Ministry of Health, and the third one, the Programme of Food, Alimentation, is a Ministry of Agriculture and Agro-Industry Programme. So there's this very important tension which is only really starting to come to the fore in obesity discourses about production and consumption, and for the time being a lot of emphasis has been placed on health aspects, but there's this whole food production aspect in the background which deserves a lot more attention. So the BMI, as we have seen, is the standardized and increasingly contested measure of obesity. The causes of the rising rates of obesity are still uncertain, and the links between cardiovascular disease and diabetes and obesity are still being investigated. It's not clear why certain obese people do develop these pathologies and others don't. So there's this kind of amalgam of stating it's a disease is quite problematic in that respect as well. So in this context, developing effective public health measures is a real challenge for policy people in this area. Obesity is a condition that not all people consider a problem, much less an illness, and there's a huge debate at the moment in obesity science. I'm thinking of the work of Julie Guthman or Gard, who are contesting the construction of this obesity epidemic, and there's a whole sort of discussion about the way the numbers are being used. The question of the BMI is central here. The threshold between obesity and overweight was lowered by 2 points of the BMI at the end of the 90s, I think, making 2 million Americans overweight overnight, obese overnight. So these kind of issues of standardization have massive impacts for the way in which care happens after in the clinic, or people are solicited to take charge of their fat. So all this requires that we pay attention to how knowledge about obesity as a biological, a public health, and a socioeconomic problem is constructed and interpreted, and there are obviously tremendous variations between national contexts. And Ulrike, you mentioned in your paper the work of, I forget who talks about obesity epidemic entrepreneurs, and I think there's a real question here about how changing paradigms of public health sort of urgencies get constructed, and there's a lot of money in obesity, and a lot of people are sort of producing data about obesity because that's where the money is, as it were. So analyzing the ideas that circulate in expert documents and French nutrition conferences and drawing on interviews with public health nutritionists here in France, I trace the emergence of a sensorially hyperstimulated, obesity-prone subject in public health. Neuroprevention, or nudging, as they've come to be known and as they're sort of making their entrance into public or into health promotion circles, rather, and gaining momentum here in France, consider that health behaviors cannot be modified through cognitive approaches alone. And we heard a lot about the importance of information in your paper, Enrique, so there's a lot of parallels here. So these approaches, these information-centered ones, or these neuroprevention, rather, and nudging, which is very big in the UK in particular, deem that educating eaters has a limited impact, given that individuals' rational decision-making capacities are strategically impaired by the marketing tactics of big food. So what are the implications of contesting the efficacy of interventions that target the rational subject for the public health response to the so-called epidemic rise in obesity? What happens when the sensorial or the unconscious or the non-rational aspects of decision-making become objects of public health interventions? So I want to explore these issues by considering what the political value of knowledge and ignorance are made to be in this specific context. Recent work in social theory has turned attention to how unknowing is not simply the absence of knowledge, but may be actively produced by social practices. My focus is on the attribution of ignorance to others and on the strategic use of non-knowledge or uncertainty, the production of ignorance in a sense, to maintain the responsibility in the field of individual health behavior. So the paper considers how, as the boundaries of nutrition, which was once just about sort of dietetics, as these are stretched to include the psychological, the psychiatric, the socioeconomic, the environmental factors, the problem of relating all these scales becomes particularly acute. So the first section is on health education in a context of uncertainty. So the PNNS, the French National Program for Nutrition and Health, which is basically a health promotion, it's before people get obese, so it's about informing people on, you know, what is a good diet and how to move as well. That's also a very central point. So this program is explicitly identifies information, communication, and education as its main strategic lever. Despite considerable investment in such campaigns, obesity rates are still said to be rising. And this points to the limit. So within these policy circles, there's a big debate about whether informing is actually useful and what, you know, what regime of proof do we have about the use of informing. In some contexts, they're even saying that the more we've informed, the more the social economic inequality has risen. So socially privileged people are gaining more benefit from the education campaigns, and that's making the gap bigger. So there's a big question about the use of informing. Traditionally, health education was premised on hierarchical models of knowledge transfer in which ignorant individuals were deemed incapable of making appropriate health decisions. A second temporality, which reached into the mid-1980s, conceived of individuals as competent but information deficient. Theories of choice that have dominated the study of health behavior have been founded on the rational autonomous actor. In the new behavioral economics that is all the rage in this area here in France, this agent is also driven by unconscious factors and aims to change behaviors without engaging people cognitively. So increasingly, attention is turning to the way that foods and the environments in which they are chosen exert their influences on eaters, and these influences are seen to be lying just beyond the realm of rational control. And marketing here is a big issue. So if existing information communication type approaches have failed, as some are arguing, it is not only because people don't do what they know that they should, but also because they are quite literally bombarded with information that is contradictory, difficult to apply, or just at complete odds with the available foodscapes or with their work routines. So much of the scholarship in the area of evidence-based policy focuses on the difficulties of knowing complex realities, but less has focused on the way in which complexity and uncertainty are both productive and actively produced. In a recent paper published by the Lancet Non-Communicable Disease Action Group, the authors examined the effect of corporate behavior on health, and they're looking at pharmaceutical, the tobacco industry, and the food and drink industry. And the paper proposes the term industrial epidemics to distinguish between the spread of disease through biological agents and through what they call corporate disease vectors. The Lancet NCD Action Group analyzes the way in which industries actively avoid regulation through a range of techniques, which are not new and we've heard about before, which include revolving doors, delivering health promotion programs in the place of states, mounting research and funding research to systematically bias results, ghostwriting, co-opting policymakers, lobbying politicians, or emphasizing free choice, which is a big deal in the US debate about obesity. It's also very important to note the superior financial capacity of the food and drink industry to compete in the realm of knowledge production. To give but one example, Danone's Vitalpol Global Research Facility invests 130 million euros annually in research in this area. Public health research is comparatively underfunded, obliging researchers to enter into public-private partnerships. The voluntary self-regulation of the industry, which is the main strategy that's promoted by the PNNS in France, is vastly inefficient, has at best a very limited impact. And in French health policy circles, a widely circulating public secret is that the state can do nothing or very little to tackle obesity, given that the agro industry is the nation's biggest employer. In a paper entitled Will to Ignorance, Lindsay Magui considers the work that goes into making things unknown. Her typology of strategic ignorance includes defensive ignorance, in which willful blindness or oversight are used strategically to exonerate from the need to take action. Factual ignorance emerges when complex and contradictory or competing scientific facts are used as a form of political capital. So she draws on Nicholas Luhmann to argue that uncertainty is a rhetorical tool that can shift the blame for whoever communicates ignorance is excused. In the context of obesity, I want to argue, the production of this field of non-knowledge, or the rise of this sort of this domain of uncertainty and we don't know how to act over this problem, effectively shifts the blame back to individuals. So in the next section, I want to consider the limits of public health scalar logic. And a key question for public health experts concerns the means of intervening on health behaviors. And these are some illustrations, some sort of concentric circle scalar representations of how to change behavior on health that circulate widely in the sort of policy presentation in the conferences that I've been attending, and these and variations on these. So they represent concentric circles which place the individual at the center of consecutive layers of interpersonal, community, organizational, or policy influences. And these are very sort of reified static models that don't really give any sort of sense of the interaction that happens between the different levels. And they also place the modern rational decision-making individual at the heart of public health action. And one question we could ask is, how different would public health be if public policy or if socioeconomic factors were at the center of the concentric spheres in place of the individual? So in a sense, this is the sort of layers that Bruno Latour was speaking of. And what's really interesting in these graphs is that the biological completely disappears. So subsequent models attempt to sort of unpack or problematize these different categorizations to show them the interactions between them in a more dynamic way, or to sort of add on extra layers or different scales to sort of give a greater sense of the complexity involved. And one example of this adding on or multiplying of scales is the sort of the discourse that's taking place around the obesogenic environment, which is a term. I mean, this is a sort of typical representation of the sort of carbon-centered, suburban, calorie-dense environment that is being referred to here. So this term was coined to refer to the sum of influences that the physical, ecological, social, or built environments place on populations and individuals, promoting high energy intake and sedentary behavior. The growing availability of hyperpalatable foods, which are processed industrial foods in urban environments, is increasingly presented as a major contributing factor to the rise in obesity. Hyperpalatability is the fine-tuning of foods by the industry to enthrall the senses, stimulate appetites, override satiety, and motivate eaters to pursue more of that taste. A closer look at this reveals how it collapses the scalar logic and the representations of the categories such as body, individual, environment, or the socio-political. Here, macroeconomic forces directly and quite deliberately target the biochemistry of appetite regulation. And this is a fine science. There's whole sort of departments dedicated to understanding what drives people to eat certain types of food in sort of addictive fashion. Recent work on the role of the sensorial process in appetite control revealed the ways in which social norms regulating foodscapes become enfolded in the molecular processes that regulate hunger. So this is typically when you see an image of a chocolate bar in the train station and it tells you you're going to be hungry and you actually experience that hunger. This is how social practices imprint themselves materially in or on bodies. In the cybernetic models that are used to think these relations, foods, fat cells, the gut, the brain regions, and pleasure receptors are given agentic properties capable of undermining eaters' capacities to make rational choices. And here are some illustrations from the Journal of Neurobiology, which attempt to sort of render these connections between, at the top here, you have the environment and lifestyle and things like social habits or taste or availability cues, and through the brain, the sort of mediation of how it impacts and feeds back with the different parts of the body. The angst surrounding obesity is partly linked to the nature of the problem it is seen to represent. Putting all these scales together, these consecutive models I've sort of illustrated, gives rise to something like this, and this is the Foresight Obesity System Map, which is an almost absurdly complex representation. And I can't go into the politics and the history of this particular map, but it was devised by the Foresight Group in the UK in 2007. And what's interesting here is that it draws connection between physiology, food production, psychology, the physical environment, and attempts to sort of map these relations out in specific ways. The problem of scale is particularly evident in obesity conferences, and I won't go into this, but there's a vast number of different sort of specialities going from obesity clinicians to people working on animal models, epigenetics, I mean, social scientists, obviously, and health economics. And attending these events, it's just flabbergasting. There's just, I mean, such levels of complexity operating at each different scale, and no formalized way of thinking how to integrate the knowledge that's produced at each one of these different scales, from the molecular to the epidemiological. So the problem is how to hold an increasingly complex representation together. What relations are crafted between the ontologically different entities held in these different models, from brain parts to blood sugar measures, from experiences of hunger to the spatial politics of food distribution, from metabolic hormones to agrarian policies? Who defines these different relations and to what goal? From my observations of these policy meetings and these conferences, a central issue is that of measurement or quantifying demonstrations of efficacy, because the objective in the end is to understand this in order to act on the problem. So take the concept of the obesogenic environment. There's quite a lot of hope about how this could be a means of addressing social determinants of health and all of this, but the published literature on the subject is concerned principally with the methodological difficulties of measuring different groups' exposure to the environment with GPS and, again, the whole statistics that goes with it, and debates about whether proximity to a supermarket is an index of healthy eating or not, and there's, in the States it is, in France it's not, so the classic problem for indicators and their sometimes absurd nature. In short, the question that is posed in this literature is an operational one concerned with how to change health behaviours through small modifications of the built environment. So coming back to Nicholas Luhmann and his essay, The Ecology of Ignorance, Luhmann asks whether ignorance might not in the end be the most important resource for action. This begs the question of what is action and who carries it out. In the context of the public health construal and response to the problem of obesity, the difficulty of implementing measurably effective interventions is both a problem for action and an endless resource to fuel further action. Luhmann suggests, and I quote, problems can be solved by not solving them, end quote. That is, by maintaining them as open. This leads him to an interesting conclusion which may be of particular value to the themes of this conference, and I quote again, the more unsolvable a problem is, the higher its reproductive value. This sabotages the hope that we can force such problems into being organizational tasks and thereby ensure that they will be dealt with in an expert manner, end quote. In other words, he suggests that proceeding from an ecology of ignorance would lead to an organizational theory that is better able to recognize that complex problems cannot be broken down into quantifiable objectives or turned into strategic interventions with quantified regimes of efficacy. His insights on the challenges posed to organizational theory by complex problems and the role of ignorance and non-knowing are very useful for theorizing public health approaches to obesity, which is typically about this sort of reproduction of the problem. Classical organizational theory, or of the kind that underlays many public health interventions, operates on a mechanistic model of goal realization. Outputs are achieved according to a logic of rational planning. If this model of organization has worked well for manufacturing, it becomes more delicate when it seeks to engineer specific human behaviors. So to conclude, the first argument I've developed concerning the uncertainty that characterizes the field of obesity draws on Luhmann's call to attune oneself to the political capital inherent in appearing uncertain rather than authoritative. As Luhmann has noted, strategic ignorance and uncertainty serve the rhetorical purpose of eluding certain responsibilities. The appeal to uncertainty in nutrition policy is increasingly being interpreted as shifting responsibilities back to the purported ignorance of individuals. And some public health journals, notably the Public Health Policy Journal, are signaling that they're not going to be publishing work on individual determinants of obesity anymore because it's a form of covering or downplaying the responsibilities of industry. So there's in PLOS Medicine also, there's been quite a lot of publications recently on this dynamic, but it's an emergent factor and it's sort of a small drop in an ocean of this other stuff that's going on. So the second argument I've made here concerns the problem of complexity and ensuing uncertainty about obesity's etiology, not to mention the question of whether obesity is really a problem at all. But the problem of obesity's complexity conceals an assumption about the possibility of developing an efficient intervention through the accumulation of evidence and the computing, scaling up, or translating of this evidence into replicable practices of care or prevention. The idea is implicitly that we need more evidence, more knowledge, and more powerful tools and models to link the types of evidence produced, from the genetic to the individual and the interpersonal, the community, to adopt the indigenous terms that circulate in these conferences. So there's an important epistemological question here concerning the kinds of things that can be known and concerning the relationship between knowledge and action. These interrogations have much to gain by considering not only what can be known and what can be established as a valid regime of proof, but also what is actively made unknown. Thank you.
Nous avons l'impression que nous avons une information, un déluge d'informations et d'injonctions sur l'obésité. Et je pense que vous avez très bien fait de souligner qu'il y a en fait une profonde ignorance de beaucoup de ces aspects, voire une stratégie de l'ignorance. C'est ça le point, un des points originaux de votre présentation. Et je voudrais souligner le fait qu'en parlant de cette ignorance, le fait qu'on sait très peu de choses sur l'impact sur l'obésité, des nouvelles façons de manger, et aussi de ce qui a, donc les comportements, mais aussi de ce qui arrive dans l'assiette. Vous parliez du supermarché, ce qui est dans le supermarché, ce qui est vendu dans le supermarché, quel rôle cela joue dans notre obésité et aussi dans notre pathologie plus généralement. Voilà un point qui sera très important de discuter. Merci beaucoup. Alors j'appelle maintenant, I call all the speakers to come back. And I apologize for those who think that maybe they had not enough time.